Hello, this is Peter Fisher, and welcome to episode 12 of The Fisher Files. Tonight we'll be talking about what to read, what to keep track of, and sort of wrapping things up for this last 12 episodes. So this final episode is this final of the first set. We're going to talk about, as a educated scientist or practicing academic, what you should keep track of and some tips on how to keep track of it. And then also kind of summarize a few things for these past 12 episodes. So, of course, as academics, we're really responsible for keeping track of what's going on in our field and exchanging ideas with colleagues and so on. And probably we all do that to varying degrees. And people keep track of things in very, very different ways. In the broader sense, though, it's important to try to become educated as widely as possible and learn how to do that. Now, one of the problems is that as fields become very, very specialized, it's very, very difficult to read their original publications. I can read and follow most publications in particle physics and to a lesser degree in nuclear physics. However, when I get into atomic physics or condensed matter physics, it becomes very heavy going. And things in biology, chemistry, most things I simply can't read. I don't know the language. I don't know the issues well enough. And that presents a problem. So I consider it very important just for me to read a couple of the more prominent generalist journals, Science and Nature, as you've probably guessed from my mind feeds, each week. They both tend to be tend towards the sensational in that they do try to actively find the most interesting, provocative articles. But week to week, their perspectives section do have sort of review articles on different topics, which are accessible to just about anyone who's in science. And that's really valuable because you can see a lot of connections there. The other thing I find very valuable to read in both Science and Nature are the book reviews. And this has led me to read quite a number of books, some of them quite surprising. For example, one book that I'm reading right now is called Wild Trees, which is about very, very tall redwoods and what goes on in the canopy of redwood forest. Another book I was led to read was Spectrum of Belief, about Fraunhofer and the German dominance of optics in the early 18th century. I started reading that book to learn about what optics was like back then, but it turned out that this was really a book written by an epistemologist who was far more interested in grinding some little academic axe he had about what Fraunhofer did and thought when, in order to convince me that his critic, who thought Fraunhofer did something some other time, this was all just lost on me. But it was a good book. And the book reviews are a really good thing to look at in Science and Nature. Physical review letters, I think for any physicist, is a must. And I think each week, it's really kind of incumbent to go and read every title. Now, many of them won't mean anything, but you will come across a lot of of interesting things. And if you find the title interesting, then you can read the abstract. And in, if you find the abstract interesting, then you can actually go in and read the paper. Again, this is very valuable for getting a general view. Just by reading the titles, you begin to pick up words that will make sense to you in colloquia, and you learn a little bit of the language of different fields. If you teach or are interested in pedagogical things, or more just interested in deeper understanding of things, the American Journal of Physics is just excellent. This is a monthly journal that's really oriented towards teaching physics at all levels. And one of the valuable things they have are resource letters, which are kind of compendiums of references for different topics. There's an excellent article from American Journal of Physics on, for example, the Kennedy assassination that was written by Louis Alvarez. So there's a wealth of good stuff in American Journal of Physics. Just to be able to talk to people, I find it valuable to read the New York Times science section. And we'll come to how to do that later if you don't subscribe to the New York Times. And Physics Today, of course. Although Physics Today, of all the things I've mentioned, I kind of find the least interesting. Kind of the one good thing they have in there is reference frame. I say that because Dan Kleppner and Frank Wilczek frequently write articles for that, and they generally write pretty well. Now, stepping even further back, it's important to be broadly informed, and I would strongly suggest that you should be reading a newspaper each day. I used to go through the Boston Globe and read the headline of every single article in the ABC sections. And again, just to get some sense of what's going on, so that if you find you really have to learn about something, you're not starting from zero. Now, all of these things can be automated to a large degree. And one of the software tools I've found very valuable is what's called a news aggregator. The one I use is called NetNewsWire, but there are a bunch of them, and I think even Netscape and Safari and Mozilla have the ability to handle RSS feeds, which are real simple syndications feeds. These things work in the following way. It's a software tool that brings up a window when you open it, and you subscribe to different websites. And what the websites do is, to your aggregator, they send the title of each section or each article. It's up to the person writing it how they format it. But for example, New York Times, you see the headlines. And then under the headline, you see one or two sentences. So what you're presented with is just line by line a series of headlines that you can scroll through relatively quickly. And then if you find something interesting, you can just click on it and it opens in the browser. And if it's something you want to save, you can just flag it as something to save. And what happens if you save it is you're actually not saving the article, you're saving the link. So it goes easy on the disk space. And I find this a really excellent way to go through things quickly. So both Science and Nature have RSS feeds, as does New York Times. To my knowledge, Physics Today does not, nor does American Journal of Physics. Physical Review Letters does, although you can just go directly to Prola and subscribe and get an email message of Physics Focus, which is a link to the most interesting thing in Physical Review Letters each week, and from there get to the table of contents. But for the sake of, you know, just cleanness, I put everything into my aggregator. Let's see, I mentioned the New York Times is there. And this is just a really valuable, quick way to go through everything. Oh, also in the aggregator is the Los Alamos archive. So you don't have to get those, you know, long, irritating email messages. They just show up in your aggregator. And, you know, each day they're kind of between 5 and 10 high-energy physics or experimental high-energy physics articles that you can very quickly go through. For the Los Alamos feed, what happens is you see the title of the paper and you click on it and you get the abstract. And then if you want the paper, it's just one more click. And again, you can flag it and save it. So doing this every day will kind of keep you aware on a very, very broad front and also alert you to a timely manner to what's going on in your specific areas of interest. Of course, you can use the aggregator to subscribe to a bunch of other things. One of the things I've mentioned before is 43 Folders has an RSS feed as well as a podcast. And that's a good thing to drop into your aggregator. And there's a whole zoo of organization things. And I'll put those up on the program notes. So whatever way you do it, and I've just told you the way I do it, it's very important to keep broadly informed if you're going to be an effective scientist. Most of the large discoveries have really come from people who thought broadly and not really from people who, you know, beavered away in some corner. So really make an effort to read things and try to think broadly and read books too. Don't be afraid to read. For example, Alan Guth's inflation book, even if you are already a cosmologist. You learn a lot by reading something that's written simply. Also, your ability to write improves, I've found. Okay, so that's what to read. Now, I'd just kind of like to summarize what's happened up till now in the past 12 podcasts and see about how to move on. Remember, the big goal in our discussions has been trying to connect the major aims or themes of your life with the 200 little daily tasks. And I've talked about systems for doing this, either using systems on your computer or index cards. And I've tried to give you some pointers of places to look for more detail. Getting Things Done by David Allen and 43 Folders have been, you know, particularly large sources of inspiration. And I've also kind of put forward the idea that your time as an academic, at least in my view, is going to involve a lot of interruption, a lot of discussion, and probably more chaos than you'd like. And I think that's good. I think one of the problems I have with things like 43 Folders and another podcast that I was interested listening to today that was quite good is a lot of the organizational stuff are driven by people who work on projects. So they get a contract to develop some piece of code or some website or something like that, and they go and do that. And maybe they work in a very small group of people, or maybe they work alone. But their days are much less about freely flowing ideas than ours are. That's not to say that they don't have ideas, and that's not to say that their jobs aren't creative and driven by ideas, but a university and being around a university is much more about talking to people informally in a relaxed way. We don't have deliverables the same way they do, and we should try to enjoy that. So that's been one point. The other point has been the connection between the large and small. And the third point is just trying to work mindfully. trying to think about your day and how it's structured and how it's organized and how your work relates to your family and your private time, and trying to keep those things in balance by trying to kind of keep a grip on stuff and keep the noise down to the lowest level and things like that. So that's what I've been trying to do. I hope I've succeeded to some extent, at least with one person. I don't know how many of you are actually listening. Just today, I've kind of had a new world open. I've been listening to a new podcast, and there's a new book out called The 4-Hour Workweek, which is kind of the things I've been talking about on steroids. And I'll post both of those things. Again, these are written by, these are mainly people in the consulting world. And so as you read them, keep in mind that they're lives and aims are a little bit different than yours. So don't just blindly apply what they say. And the message of all of this has been, think about what you're doing. For this week's Mind Feed, I'm just going to talk about one article, which is written by Simon White, and it was apparently written after a lunchtime talk he gave at the Kavli Institute at Slack, and the title is something like Fundamentalism and Why Dark Energy is Bad for Astronomy. And I found this article, which was passed to me by Paul Schechter, interesting for a number of reasons. For those of you not in the field, one of the things that's happened in the last 10 years is a series of very important measurements, the measurements in the microwave background, measurements of distant supernova, and measurements of the distribution of galaxies at different redshifts have come together and given us a new picture of the universe that indicates that there is a substance called dark energy, which is 73% of the energy in the universe, and we don't know what it is. And there's another substance, dark matter, which is about 25%. And we don't know what that is either. And then there's 2%. That's the stuff we know. This model also is consistent with inflation, the rapid expansion of the universe at early time, and Big Bang nucleosynthesis. Now, the impact of this is almost impossible to judge at this point. It's certainly huge. It's clearly, for the 20th century, probably one of the two or three most important revelations or important experimental results. It also comes at a time when, in particle physics, we've reached a stage where the model we have that describes most interactions, the standard model, is very complete and works very well. So experiments are becoming fewer and harder. The Large Hadron Collider is coming and may open up a new energy scale. But those are very large experiments. And the point is, all of this is happening at a time of sort of contraction and retrenchment in particle physics. And what's happened is a lot of particle physicists are moving into cosmology. Part of the reason for this is that one of the teams that did the supernova work were ex-particle physicists. And part of the reason is that this is just really very interesting stuff. What this article talks about is that there are really kind of fundamental differences, cultural differences between particle physics and astronomy. And I've been talking to Paul Schechter about this for a long time, but this article really crystallized it. Particle physicists are fundamentalists, and we spend our time trying to understand the fundamental laws of nature. And for us, doing physics is trying to understand how everything works at the most basic, irreducible level. Astronomers look out at the cosmos through telescopes, at objects, and make measurements of those objects and use physics to try to determine what they are and how they work. Occasionally, they'll discover a new physical law, and it's very important when they do. But their aim is really not to create physics. Their aim is to understand nature and to use physics to see how things work. And consequently, it's quite a broad community. There are people who study the planets. There are people who look for exoplanets. There are people who study the objects in the Kuiper Belt. There are people who study comets. There are people who study galaxies, clusters of galaxies, the distribution of superclusters of galaxies. There are cosmologists who study everything. And I think until recently, there was, you know, certainly kind of a pecking order between these areas, or not a pecking order, but, you know, some were deemed more important than others, as is inevitable. But that was more, I think, that ranking was driven more by what was happening in different areas. If something was hot, it meant there was a lot of experimental work going on at the time. Now, they're kind of being swept over by this cosmology, which is really all about fundamentalism. And part of this is that particle physicists are sweeping into the field, and I wouldn't say taking it over, but changing its course. And this is what Simon White writes about. It brings up a lot of interesting things. Fields of endeavor like astronomy or particle physics or physical chemistry have trajectories, and they evolve. And in fact, I was looking in a old MIT bulletin when I was at the MIT Museum yesterday, and there was a copy of the course catalog from, I think it was the late 1930s. There was a department of metallurgy at MIT. Now, there's no department of metallurgy. It probably morphed into materials science. But what I'm trying to say is that just because a field is very prominent and very important at one time doesn't mean that's always going to be so. And it could be that, you know, particle physics is coming to an end. We've done everything we can do. And now people are going off in different directions, and maybe a new kind of particle physics will emerge. Maybe not. A lot of those people are going into astronomy, which is, as always, an active and vibrant field. And this is forcing the astronomers to evolve. And to some extent, it's going to force them to accept, you know, very large collaborations of people. The real question is, should they be forced to accept or have imposed upon them fundamentalism, that the most important things in the field are things that are measuring the most basic laws? And I don't really know the answer to that. Clearly, there are some people who do, like David Gross, who argues with Simon White quite vociferously, a little video that I'll post about exactly this. But the message I want to leave you with is, as academics, it's not just about choosing some problem and working on it very, very hard and trying to solve it. Especially as you get older in your career, it's about stewardship, and it's about trying to guide a field in a way so that it remains productive and vibrant and strong. And my fear is that this really kind of hasn't happened very well in particle physics in the last 20 years, at least not in this country. I have the very strong sense of struggling. Maybe that's not right. I don't know. I'm happy if somebody calls me and corrects me. Anyway, so this is just something for you to think about. So that's it for this episode 12, and that's kind of the end of this initial set of 12 podcasts on connecting the big and the small, and it's been fun to do, and I hope it's helped at least one person. What I'm planning to do from here isn't quite clear. I do want to spend some time working on the website. And I do want to spend some time thinking about what the next podcast will be. So therefore, I'm going to take off 2 weeks and resume 2 weeks from today. I've also got some money to buy new recording equipment and some other things. And so Sheila and I will be working on that. So don't unsubscribe if you have a just subscribe to this. In the meantime, you can listen to 43 folders or some of the other things that I'll post. If you have some idea for something that you'd like to see done on this podcast, please email me at fisherp.mit.edu or use the contact form on the webpage. So I'll see you in 2 weeks, and until then, have fun with your work and your life in Cambridge or wherever you are. I could have given you all I had to share if you were only there. Without a care.